Hello there. Today is Wednesday, September 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Hurricane Dorian is finally starting to slowly move away from the Bahamas, but now veering toward the U.S. East Coast.
This is the time for us as Bahamians to show our love, our care, and our compassion for our fellow brothers and sisters.
Britain's government is in a state of turmoil over exiting the European Union. Also ahead, an unusual form of protest in New York City. It's all on today's International Edition. Hurricane Dorian carved a path of destruction through the Bahamas, and relief officials Tuesday were preparing for a humanitarian crisis after one of the most powerful storms ever to hit the islands killed at least 7 people, with the scale of the disaster yet unknown. Bahamas Prime Minister Hubert Minnis said the Abaco Islands have been devastated.
They are deeply worrying. The images and videos we are seeing are heartbreaking. Many homes, businesses, and other buildings have been completely or partially destroyed.
Aerial video recorded over the Bahamas' Great Abaco Island showed mile upon mile of flooded neighborhoods, pulverized buildings, upturned boats, shipping containers scattered like Lego toys. And now for the latest on that storm and where it continues to head, we are joined by Rick Knapp, Dr. Rick Knapp, a hurricane specialist with the Weather Channel. Thank you for being with us. Well, after pretty much parking itself over the Bahamas, I understand that Dorian is now slowly starting to move toward the eastern U.S. coast.
The center has started moving northwestward away from the Bahamas. They're still getting some tropical storm force winds down on Grand Bahama, but the eye wall has moved away, and by tomorrow morning, things will have calmed down considerably so that the recovery can truly begin. But it was a long 3 days of just catastrophic, devastating wind and storm surge in Grand Bahama and the Abacos, and now it's starting to lash the east coast of Florida with tropical storm conditions, and we're going to have a hurricane coming dangerously close to the shoreline of South Carolina in the next day and a half. The center of Dorian is not going to come to shore in Florida, but the west side of the circulation is hammering the east coast of central Florida right now with tropical storm conditions, very dangerous ocean conditions, the waves and the rip currents. People have to be staying out of the water and away from the coast. We can see some power outages from the tropical storm force winds on the east coast of Florida. And that will continue well into the day tomorrow before the center, you know, gets north of Florida by tomorrow night.
When you mentioned the Carolinas, are they expecting it to be stronger, or what are you expecting once it moves past Florida?
Well, we might not see much change in strength. It's a Category 2 hurricane right now, but it's a large one. And a large Category 1 or 2 hurricane is going to be either making landfall with the center crossing the coast and in either South Carolina or North Carolina or coming very, very close to doing so. And either way, a large hurricane is going to bring hurricane force winds, a life-threatening storm surge, and heavy rainfall. So, you know, those hurricane warnings and evacuations that have been called on the coast of South Carolina and North Carolina, people need to heed those. Could be as life-threatening and damaging as Hurricane Matthew was 3 years ago.
So even though it isn't quite as strong of a hurricane as it was in the Bahamas, it can still obviously really cause a lot of problems, is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
As far as anybody being able to deal with a hurricane like we just saw in the Bahamas, you know, a Category 5 that just literally sticks around for days, pounding one particular location. Would you say that regardless of any sort of preparation, it would be impossible to avoid, you know, massive destruction?
There's unfortunately no surprise that a slow-moving Category 5 hurricane over a low-lying populated area has caused devastation. The only way to ensure survival in those kinds of wind and storm surge flooding conditions is to evacuate, and this wasn't feasible to move all of those people off of those islands. And so a lot of folks went through a terrifying 3-day period from one end of the storm to the other. A slow-moving major hurricane over a low-lying populated area is the worst kind of hurricane.
I imagine we probably haven't even heard the worst of what has happened on the islands yet.
It will take some time for us to have a full picture of what's happened in the northwestern Bahamas. Communications are down. Access to all of the places that were impacted is difficult, and it's going to be a very, very long recovery, and it's going to take some time for us to get the full scope of the disaster.
And we're not even at the end of hurricane season.
We're only halfway through the hurricane season, and there are plenty of months left where more activity could occur. And in fact, there are other systems out there and other systems that could form later. We have a tropical storm in the southwestern Gulf of Mexico headed into Mexico. We have a new tropical depression out in the eastern Atlantic, and we have a long way to go. So people need to be paying attention to the tropics for weeks and weeks to come.
All right, that is Dr. Rick Knapp. He is a hurricane specialist with the Weather Channel. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump is warning China against a delay in reaching a trade pact. Walmart will stop selling ammunition for handguns and assault-style weapons. Turkey is bracing for a new jihadi threat. And Hong Kong's leader denies resignation talks with Beijing. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Dozens of people have been arrested in the South African city of Johannesburg after rioters looted shops and torched buildings and vehicles. Police fired tear gas, rubber bullets, and stun grenades in an attempt to quell the unrest yesterday. Many of the targeted shops are reported to be owned by foreign nationals. VOA's Yehusi Wu-Heeb talks to Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Thanks so much, my friend. I appreciate it.
Darren, first, tell us the extent of the violence and where it is occurring, and why are black South Africans attacking other Africans?
Well, at the moment, it is mainly concentrated in Johannesburg, although today also saw incidents in Durban, Cape Town, Pretoria. Basically, though, it's here in Johannesburg today. Police really battled to contain the mayhem. They fired rubber bullets at the plunderers. They arrested many people. Now, in the areas that I visited and where the violence happened today, there are rocks, smoldering car tires everywhere. Everywhere you see shell casings from police firearms. There was also a lot of trouble over here in Joburg in the township of Alexandra. Over there, people hurled rocks at businesses that they said were owned by foreigners. They sang songs to the effect that the Makwere Kwere, which is a derogatory term they use to refer to migrants, should leave South Africa or suffer the consequences. Now, from what I've seen on the ground, the looters are indeed targeting businesses owned by foreigners. But, however, once the mob mentality takes over, it's sort of open season, so to speak. And the crowds loot South African stores as well, and also attack and assault South Africans. In the city this morning, there was a dead body of a woman. There were burnt out cars and buses. Then there's also a lot of pieces of footage of violence being distributed in South Africa on social media of people being doused with petrol and set alight. Apparently these are foreigners, but this isn't confirmed as yet. So you've got all these things happening, and it's very complex.
So, Darren,
it's not just about xenophobia. Yes.
So is there maybe criminality added to all this?
There's definitely criminals taking advantage of the situation. I don't think, despite what the government says, there can be any doubt that foreigners are being targeted. But from what I've seen, there's definitely criminals that hijack the situation and take advantage and start looting, et cetera, et cetera. And they really don't care who they steal from, whether it's foreigners or not. But from what I've seen, there definitely is an element of xenophobia involved. And, you know, what we're dealing with here in South Africa is that every few months, foreigners who are present in our cities in big numbers get blamed for the fact that locals don't have access to resources, that locals are still poor, etc., etc. It's easy to blame the foreigners. It's easy to target them rather than addressing the root causes of these problems rather than confronting the power of the government.
So you just mentioned root cause. Darren, it is important to see these events within their context. South Africa is home to many immigrants who never get attacked, and there are many South Africans who get caught up in the senseless violence as well. Could the whole problem be an immigration issue? The unemployment rate in South Africa being 28%, and these places, huge pressure on the lower end of the social ladder here.
Look, definitely. But I don't see, from my experience and all the experts that I've spoken to, I don't think that foreigners are taking South African jobs. Quite the contrary. In my experience, foreigners are mostly creating jobs. But if you go to the really poor areas of South Africa and you see people from Bangladesh, people from Nigeria, et cetera, opening up stores, then it's easy to say, hey, look at these guys. They're taking our jobs. They have access to resources. They're making our money. Whereas, you know, we know that South Africa is a very unequal place. Half the population lives below the poverty line. The other half is split between those who are just a bit better off than that. And then you have a middle class. And of course, like many other places in the world, a tiny elite that controls the majority of wealth. But from what I've seen on the ground, I don't think it is necessarily a problem about foreigners stealing South African resources, et cetera, et cetera. We are dealing with a much bigger problem in South Africa, and that is the failure of the government to create opportunities for everyone, not only locals, for everyone who are present in South Africa.
Darren Taylor in Johannesburg, thank you for your input.
A cross-party alliance defeated Boris Johnson in Parliament Tuesday in a bid to prevent him from taking Britain out of the EU without a divorce agreement, prompting the Prime Minister to announce that he would immediately push for a snap election. 21 lawmakers in the ruling Conservative Party rebelled against Johnson by backing the first step toward legislating to block a no-deal Brexit, despite threats that they would be expelled from the Conservative Party. Tory rebel Dominic Grieves saying he feels compelled to challenge Boris Johnson's apparent commitment to a no-deal Brexit and plan to sack colleagues who don't agree with him.
I acknowledge that if the Prime Minister carries out his threat, I will cease to be a member of the Conservative Party and will no longer be taking the whip. That's a matter for him. It's an extraordinary and draconian thing to do, particularly coming from somebody who's rebelled on a number of occasions in respect of the EU in the course of his career.
But Johnson says there will be no extension on leaving the EU with or without a deal.
I want everybody to know there are no circumstances in which I will ask Brussels to delay. We're leaving on the 31st of October, no ifs or buts.
Well, more than 3 years after the United Kingdom voted in a referendum to leave the European Union, the defeat leaves the course of Brexit unresolved, with possible outcomes still ranging from a turbulent no-deal exit to abandoning the whole endeavor. Joining us from London is reporter Amy Gutman. Amy, what's the latest here?
Well, there's a bit of a power struggle happening between Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is determined to leave the EU by October 31st, deal or no deal, and MPs who have called for an emergency debate that's taking place, and that will decide whether to take control of Parliament on Wednesday to extend the Brexit deadline to at least the end of January. Meantime, officials at Number 10 have warned that if Parliament is successful with this effort, Boris Johnson will push for an election, a general election, on October 14th in hopes of cementing his position, i.e., being properly elected Prime Minister. And of course, his campaign platform will be deal or no deal exit by October 31st. So he will then be able to say, look, I have this mandate. This is what the people want. And the other interesting thing about this is that he's also using it as a mechanism to get rid of those who oppose him. He's already said explicitly that any rebels that exist among the Conservatives will be expelled from the party. This is a very big deal, and it's something that many see as playing dirty. But Boris is sticking to his guns, and he sees this strategy, which includes the possibility of a no-deal Brexit, as the best bargaining power the UK has with the EU. And he believes that any other position weakens the UK's stance.
So what about no deal? Why is there so much opposition to just leaving if they can't come up with something?
Most people believe that a no deal will cause incredible damage to the economy, completely disrupt travel and the supply chain of essentials like food and medicine. And it's actually been something that so many people believe will be so harmful to the UK's economy and so many other things that it's unifying MPs rather than dividing them. So MPs have actually crossed party lines to try to prevent a no-deal Brexit. In fact, Tuesday afternoon, a Conservative MP defected parties and left the Conservatives to go over to the Lib Dems. Now, that had the impact of making sure that the Conservatives lost the majority in Parliament. So we're seeing a lot of interesting political maneuvering occur because people are so desperate to avoid the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. So again, this is a real unifying stance that many people are taking, that they'll do anything, again, even cross party lines, defect parties, to prevent a no-deal.
My understanding is that there's a proposed bill that would force Boris Johnson to request a Brexit extension. But my understanding is that members of the EU, led by French President Emmanuel Macron, are adamant that there will be no extension.
The EU may be saying that there will be no extension, but the wider belief in the UK is that if there's a prospect of a deal by extending until January 31st, then the EU will most likely agree to this.
Where do they go from here?
Well, there are two next steps. One is on Wednesday, the bill makes it to Parliament. The Labour Party, which is the opposing party, has already said 17 members of the Labour Party have already proposed an amendment to the bill in Parliament on Wednesday. They're suggesting that Parliament have another look at Theresa May's last deal proposal. Whether this is even possible is another story. And Boris Johnson calling an election is another next step. So he will most likely call a general election for October 14th.
All right. That is London-based reporter Amy Gutman. Thank you for being with us. Pope Francis is making a historic visit to Mozambique this week at the start of a three-nation Africa tour. Anita Powell has a preview.
Mozambique's seaside capital is buzzing ahead of a historic papal visit. Maputo's soaring white cathedral is eagerly preparing for Pope Francis's visit, the first since Pope John Paul II arrived in 1988, while Mozambique was in the throes of a brutal civil war. Leaders signed a new peace agreement earlier this year, and parish priest Giorgio Ferretti says that this visit, too, is historic.
Now the visit of Pope Francis is coming after the last agreement of peace, so it's a kind of a blessing for all this period of talk between the government and the opposition. But also his words about climate changing, environment, poor, and living together, they will be a great message for our country.
And beyond. Catholic pilgrim Simongile Leneke, who is 63, drove 7 hours from neighboring South Africa for the visit.
I hope he's going to say there should be peace amongst the people of South Africa. And he's spreading a lot of love within the Christians.
Although about one quarter of Mozambicans are Roman Catholic, those who are not of the faith say they'll also be paying attention. 22-year-old student Ricardo José Faustino says he thinks it will be very interesting to see the Pope here in Mozambique. Faustino is Muslim, he says, but I think I should listen to him. And others say they're listening for a specific message, like 30-year-old Catholic Dina João Mendes. She says she hopes the Pope brings a message of peace, because we need peace in this country. On Thursday, the Pope's first full day in Mozambique, he will meet with lawmakers, youth, and clergy. This is the pontiff's second trip to sub-Saharan Africa. He first visited in 2015, going to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. On this tour, he'll also visit the island nations of Madagascar and Mauritius. Anita Powell, VOA News, Maputo.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? how about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America. Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. A peculiar form of body art is gaining popularity in New York City. It's protest body art, where people paint their bodies, not with pictures and innocent images, but slogans aimed at fighting divisiveness. Nina Vishneva has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
New York protesters fighting against divisiveness have chosen a new, peculiar canvas for their slogans. Their own bodies.
If it's too thick, it's like going to waste a lot of money. If it's too thin, you'll notice because it's see-through.
Andy Golub is a body painter and artist. His specialty, slogans and images that fit exactly between the shoulders.
We feel a certain amount of shame, a little fear, because, oh my God, I'm not good enough. And so the idea is, if once you believe that, well, I'm just a human being, like I'm not supposed to be perfect, I am good enough, then all of a sudden we love ourselves. And when we love ourselves, that's only when we can love each other.
New York officials initially took a dim view of his work, and Golub was arrested for public lewdness in 2011. Those charges were eventually dropped, and these days the police don't mind, as long as the body painting is part of an organized demonstration. Artists, bankers, office workers, people of all occupations and social statuses come here to make a statement. They all share Golub's belief that human bodies are more powerful than paper and banners. His parents are his biggest fans.
Well, he's been different since the day he was born. Very special.
Yeah, we have three kids. He could be crazy, and he could be the most charming guy in the world.
One of the least popular colors, black. Golub mostly works in bright colors, so his models can portray unity and optimism.
Why am I here? I believe in spreading unity. I believe in spreading the fact that nobody needs to be divided. No matter what lifestyle or whatever, who they happen to be.
Golub says he wants to change the way people view the human body.
This is America!
And his models say it changes the way they view their own bodies. From Nina Vishneva in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
As Hurricane Dorian has left parts of the Bahamas in a total state of depression, Rihanna is already looking for ways to help her hometown and the Bahamian people and fellow Caribbeans through her Clara Lionel Foundation. She said it breaks her heart to see the devastation, and she tweeted that they are all in her prayers, and she's working to figure out how best she can help. Rihanna's humanitarian work has been setting a standard for many celebrities' philanthropy. She was even presented by Harvard University with their Humanitarian of the Year award back in 2007 for dedicating so much help to improving education and health care in the Caribbean. Been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director Tracy Carter and our engineer Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
it's not just something you take, it's given. Round and around and around and around we go. Oh, now tell me now, tell me now, tell me now, you know. Not really sure.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to stopping the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, also known as the DRC. Nearly 2,900 people have been infected since the outbreak began over a year ago, with nearly 2,000 fatalities. U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, Administrator Mark Green, recently traveled to the DRC to support and strengthen the ongoing response to the second largest outbreak of Ebola in history. He met with officials from the government of the DRC, non-governmental organizations, United Nations, and donors. Administrator Green discussed ways to better engage Ebola-affected communities in the response, strategies to increase donor funding, and ways to keep healthcare workers safe. USAID's Disaster Assistance Response Team, comprised of U.S. government experts and supported by staff at the U.S. Embassy Kinshasa, is on the ground in the DRC to help end the outbreak. Together with partners, the United States has trained more than 19,200 healthcare workers on best practices to avoid infection, supported 1,680 people to conduct disease surveillance, and strengthened infection prevention and control measures in more than 360 health facilities. The United States has also provided enough food for 300,000 people and reached more than 2 million people with critical messaging to stop disease transmission and improve local community health. Speaking at a press roundtable in the DRC, Administrator Green cited conflict and corruption as impacting the Ebola response and emphasized that fighting Ebola is not just a medical crisis, it is a development crisis. USAID is helping to address underlying development issues in the region in order to improve community trust and communication. The United States views its partnership with the DRC as a high priority, said U.S. Ambassador to the DRC Michael Hammer. That's why we have technical experts here from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We have two decades plus of a relationship with Congolese health authorities. The United States also has the National Institutes of Health on the ground in the DRC working on clinical studies of promising Ebola treatments. We see this partnership with Congo as very important, said Ambassador Hammer, not just for Congo and the American people, but for the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.